right. You see? Now, I told you that this was going to be part drug along and part idiot along, you know. But, I mean, I was not in touch. And as I look back in retrospect, I do not think that that three-piece suit and that Masonic pin was going to keep me out of jail. But I sure swore it then, you know. Now you've got to understand that by the time I got to where I had the peace symbols and the Easter Bunny shit on the side, right, that I was no longer wearing the three-piece suit. You know, I was reduced to my one and only shirt, a Hawaiian shirt that had about 2,000 weed holes, you know, from it. Because, you know, most people like to clean the weed, but I didn't want to waste any, so I just kept the seeds and everything, man. When I smoked a joint, it was like Rice Krispie time, snap, crackle, and pop, you know. And so I had these holes all over my one pair of khakis, and now I'm a heroin addict, too, so I... you know, one time went into a restroom, and the guy hollered first, and he snatched the outfit out of my hand and fixed first, you know. That never happened again, because I wore a belt that went two ways, like Pancho Villa's bandoliers, right? And I always had about 8 or 10 outfits in my pocket, so I didn't care who was going into the toilet with me. And, you know, people were talking about their kids and stuff and maladjustment and things a little earlier tonight. And you know, it's like, I was married to this girl, and I know those kids, they went through hell, you know. But we did drag them to meetings with us when we cleaned up, you know. And because when 4, 5, 6, 8, 10 adults all run in the house like a herd of buffalo hollering first, and they all run into the toilet, you know, and the kids are already 4, 5, 6, 7 years old. I mean, this is kind of like a bizarre behavior, you know. But not to me. I mean, it was normal to me. So I just went in, threw all the stuff down, pulled the belt down. I mean, it was no taking the belt. You know, we weren't going to take time for nothing. I would just slide the belt down. I mean, if we were in the car to get some water or the toilet or whatever, I was ready. That's the kind of dope fiend that I was. I mean, I was ready at all times, under all conditions, to shoot dope. One time I went down to Mexico and we hired this Mexican lady to come up and be our maid. And she thought she was hooking up with the rich Americanos. She didn't know she was going to the pits of hell, man. Because we didn't have any money to pay her. You know, we were down there copping, and we had an extra $20. And, you know, we gave her a $10 advance, but we gave her $10 a week or something for stay there, watch the kids, and do all that. But this lady, somehow, man, she had... I don't know what kind of a rare disease she must have had, but somewhere, you know, while snooping through her things like all good dope fiends would do, you know, I ran across this little kit that had this weird-looking needle, man. I mean, it must have been for horses or spinals or had some kind of metal syringe and a metal box. And this needle was about this long, had a hole in it, man, about the size of a pencil lead. And, so I knew that thing was there. So one night, some people were over to my house, and this girl says, hey, man, I know this black dude that could get us some heroin down in Willowbrook, the black section of L.A., man. And so, really? Well, it's pretty late, man, 2 o'clock. Oh, hell, that's no problem at all, man. We're going down there, and L.A. got some pink stuff. So pink stuff, you know. Yeah, man, they got pink stuff. You know, my only question was, well, is it good? And are you sure you can do it? Right. Yeah, I can do it. So away we went, man. You know, a whole carload of insane people heading for, you know, this part of town. We get down there, and it turned out to be one of those go from here and go to that club, and pretty soon the guy came out. I got no pink stuff, man, but I got some good green stuff. Green stuff. Yeah, green heroin, man. Shit, get it. So don't waste any time. It's about 3 a.m. by now. You know, look, you know, and we're looking around saying, well, you know, if we pull this carload of people, if the heat rides by, we're going to jail. And so I'm saying, no, let's just stop and get some water out of the hose in a gas station or something. Everybody was on a big panic about let's go home. So we wound up going home. Everybody's trying to cook this stuff up, and it's bubbling up like mush, you know. And nobody is touching it. They're going, ah, man, we got burned. I told my old lady, man, they don't know, man. I got it covered. She said, what do you mean you got it covered? I thought, well, I know where there's a needle that'll handle that shit. She said, you do. So I put it there. Got the Mexican maid's needle, man, you know, this big old long sucker, and I put it, she said, Jesus Christ, man. Where did you get that thing at? I said, well, don't worry about it, man. It's, they all, you know, they all think it's soap suds, but I know, man, and them people, man, you know, it's not, it's got to be green heroin. I mean, I couldn't accept the fact that we got burned, you know what I mean? And I'm there, and I'm tasting it, and I go, yeah, that stuff, man. You know, it's got that taste, you know. So I cook that sucker up, you know. Man, I shot that sucker up, man, I taste soap suds for a month. And it was just nothing but comic cleanser. So I'm here to tell you that it's a miracle that I'm here alive today, you know. I mean, it's a miracle. Yeah. That I'm here today. Because that's the way I use it. And that's just one absurd story out of many, many stories that, you know, I can tell you about myself, you know, and my own history, you know. I need to ask, how long do I have to talk? Oh, my. Come on, gang. Okay, so... You know, I want to talk a little bit more about the psychedelic era of this thing, because it's really what brought me more or less to the end. I mean, I got into a lot of stuff about relativity, and I ultimately was sitting in the middle of a floor, and I had gone over to San Francisco, and I was living in a town called Fremont over below Hayward. I don't know if anybody's familiar with the coast. But anyway, I went over and I ran into these hippies, and I told them, well, I'm trying to get some acid. And the guy said, well, the guy's not here right now, but we can give you some STP, you know. I told him, well, yeah, sure, man. They ain't, you know, that ain't no big deal, you know. And so he gave me a handful of this STP tablets, you know. And so we go up there, and on the way out, he says, well, I want to stop up here. And he says, we'll smoke a little hash. And I went in this place. It was kind of a den. And, I mean, there's about 30 or 40 people sitting around smoking hash or something, man. And this guy takes this stuff, and he drops a couple of them, man. And I'm looking at him, and he's about a... very strange person, you know, this person. He's telling me after about 20 minutes, he looked over at me and he told me, this is the baddest stuff I ever had. Now, I don't know how it's supposed to affect most people, right? I mean, I think he was trying to give me a warning, you know, right? Because he said, whatever you do, don't take over a quarter of a tab. But I saw him take two, you understand? And he's there talking about it's bad. Man, shit, I dropped two of them suckers, and I took off walking down the stoop, and I had on some Indian moccasins that came up to the bottom of my legs. It's raining, and there's hills there, man, you know, right? And the street's wet, and the Indian moccasins are wet. I keep falling down. I walk about 3 feet and fall down because I'm sliding in the moccasins. So this stuff is beginning to come on, and somehow I found this car that I was driving, and I headed out for the Bay Bridge. And I'm out there, and all of a sudden, the whole bridge just melted. It's gone. And I'm aware of the fact that I'm out in the middle of San Francisco Bay with a melted bridge. Right? And the feeling of, I think I'll get out of the car and get naked. And I'm going, oh, I think I'll keep my faith in the car. You know, right? I mean, I was going through all this stuff, you know, and I'm going and going. And man, I swear I must have drove for 8 weeks, you know. I mean, at the time, I have no idea whether I was going a mile and a half an hour or 100 miles and a half an hour, you know. But I was there, man. And it just kept going on. Pretty soon I seen this little teeny red light. And I'm headed for it, you know. And I said, stay with the car, stay with the car, stay with the car. And then I had kind of like a moment of clarity. With like, as I went through the toll station. I don't know whether the guy jumped or whether he wasn't on duty or whether it was a closed one or wherever it was, we kept going, man. And the freeway kept going like this, you know. And I got down to the end of some street that I got off the freeway. And the things were, they were doing a little better. You know, the moments of clarity were now maybe 20 or 30 seconds long at a time. But I remember arriving on this city street in front of a school, and it was only probably about 2:30 in the afternoon, and all these people's cars were parked goofy in the street, and I'm stopped, and I look over, and there's a guy that lived in that tractor near where I did, and he was a cop, used to park his motorcycle there when he was gone to lunch or something, or home for a nooner, or, you know, but, because I don't know what he was doing there at 2:30 in the afternoon, you know. Maybe it was just a pit stop, I don't know. But anyway, I'm here sitting in this car, and I get this feeling that I've been in the most gigantic wreck there ever was, because these cars are all, appear to be all crumbled and everything, you know. The next thing I know, there are no cars. And I'm just kind of coming out of it, and the whole street is empty. I go, wow, everybody went home, you know. But the cop's bike is still there. Thank God he didn't come out, you know. So I got on home, and which was kind of a weird thing. Nobody was there. So I went into the bathroom and to take a leak, and I saw a little crap stain on the edge of the toilet. So it started me thinking about, well, why are the hippies in San Francisco dirtier than the ones in Los Angeles? And you know, I'm trying to deduce this all out, man, through the theory of relativity, you know, right? And so I wind up going back to Egypt in the beginning of time and the alphabet. Ultimately, I came up with the decision that a piece of shit and an apple was the same thing. So as soon as my wife came in, I told her, you know, we're moving. She said, when? I said, now. She said, well, why? I said, because I'm going back to the San Fernando Valley where the dope is cheap and I need to use a safe drug. I'm returning to heroin. I'm afraid. I think I know now why the hippies in San Francisco were dirtier than the ones in L.A. They dropped more acid or something, you know. So I stopped. I was afraid. But I got back to town, and that's when George kind of drove up on the scene. But just a little prior to him showing up on the scene, I had another experience that was still kind of psychedelically involved, and I was endeavoring to clean up and not being too successful, and my wife and other barber went off to Cobb. We used to take turns going to Cobb, but while they were gone, I saw some junior high school kid go by with long hair, and he looked very strange, so I hollered at him out the door, and I says, "Hey, you got any drugs?" You know. So he came over and he said, "Well, no, I don't have any on me, you know, but I can get you some real quick." So I had a motorcycle and I said, "Well, okay, wait a minute, I'm going to close the door and I can't wait any longer for these people." So we put him on the back of the motorcycle and away we went. And we came back and he gave me some kind of a thing to smoke. I smoked about a half of this joint, and in came a customer, and all of a sudden I thought these rays of, from the bomb, I thought the bomb had been dropped. And so I'm telling this guy, you know, "How do you feel? Do you feel strange?" By this time I got the soap on his ear, and I got one knee down on the floor, and I'm telling him, do you feel strange? And he told me, "Yeah, I feel strange." The guy ran out of the barber shop with a hair cloth and a soap on his ear. And I'm hollering with the razor of my hand, wait, stop, don't go away, man. You're going to die out there, you know. And with that, I'm going down for the count, you know. And I went, "Oh, God." But something happened. It's one of these strange things, one of these weird stories you hear about. But I went, "Oh, God." And the whole sky blew up in brilliant red-orange. And I saw the word "God" written vividly in blue in the sky. Oh, jeez. You know, I mean, this is more than anybody can handle, right? I mean, I kind of staggered over and fell into the waiting chair. And I went, "Oh, shit, man. This is, you know, this is what these people in Narcotics Anonymous talk about, God. You know, right?" I told you I kept getting these messages in weird places, man, you know, that you kept talking about. So when they came back, I mean, I was babbling all about this stuff, and I told her, "You know, this stuff has got to stop now, and we got to start going to these meetings again." And she said, "But I'm too sick." So I put her out in front of the car. And I told her, "You got to walk around this block in front of the car. I'm going to run over you." And, you know, she got some resentment towards me, you know, this woman. And anyway, we did this all afternoon until a meeting opened in Hollywood that we knew about. And therein, you know, began probably the serious part of my recovery. So, you know, I don't want to talk much more about the drug log or the idiot log part of this situation, because that's only what brings us to where we are, regardless of what kind of story. But it is a weird story, so once in a while I share it, you know. And what I found here afterwards, I think, is far more interesting, you know. At least it is to me today, because, like I told you, it started off with a guy that knew how to talk to me, how to share the message with me, and he's the one that put me into service. I've been clean and sober for a little while, and ultimately this guy brought me a little briefcase, and he said, "You're going to need this." I said, "A briefcase for what? What has this got to do with it?" He said, "Well, because you're going to become the chairman of this meeting, and you're going to need something to carry the paperwork within and all that stuff like that. Oh, okay, great. So he was sending me on all these missions, you know, for about a year or two. He was telling me, go here, do that, go to this meeting here. I don't know what the hell I was doing. They're having a big fight over it's breaking the traditions to put an ad in the paper that says Narcotics Anonymous with a phone number, right? And there was one faction of these people, and they said it's breaking the traditions. He says, ah, man, go here and buy this sign and put it on your car, man. So I did it, man. I said, well, I'm willing to follow directions. This guy asked me in the beginning, he said, are you willing to take direction? I told him, yeah. Well, I'm glad he wasn't a faggot, you know, man. I'd have been in a world of trouble, you know. Because I made my mind up that I was going to take some directions from this guy and do exactly what he told me to do. So now I'm riding around the two little plastic signs on the side of my car that say Narcotics Anonymous and a phone number. Well, shit, man. If there wasn't a war going on in NA up to that time, there was then. Everybody divided promptly, you know, like, wow, you know, look what these people over here are doing. And, you know, and it's, it was already a split in the camps, but they went 10 miles wide with that, you know. And I just kept taking those directions. And then I decided to branch out and pay attention to some other people. And I started taking some directions from some other people. And I was very, very worried, like I said, you know, when I was asking these people, do you think I stand a chance? And I read in this book where it said, when all else fails, work with a newcomer. So that's what I did. I started loading people into the car, taking people to meetings. I started working in recovery and doing things like that. I was never seen without a newcomer that I was dragging along or had people kicking in the back of my car, well, the back of my barber shop and in my house on the couch or whatever, you know. And that's how I eat my way into the successful aspect of this program. And I've been taking directions really ever since, you know. And I learned to stand up and share what I feel in my gut is the right thing, not what I think is the right thing, because if I pay attention to my head, I'm going to get in a lot of trouble. See, because the other thing I'm going to share, and then I think I'm going to let it go for this evening, and that's what I asked my sponsor. I said, what's the one thing that we have in common? And he said, well, I want you to listen. A couple of weeks later, he asked me, he said, did you find out what we all have in common yet? I said, I don't know. And he says, come on, pay attention, man. I want you to listen. A couple of weeks later, he asked me again. After about three or four times of this, he really buttonholed me again. And he said, come on, man. It's been long enough. You've been listening to these people for years, and now you're clean and sober, and you can hear clean and sober. He says, what's the one thing everybody has in common? I said, I don't know. They're all crazy. He said, that's it. He says, now you're ready to do step two. Correct. Correct? And that's how he took me on, man. And I began to realize, yes, that my head was out to get me. And that whatever goes down between my ears is subject to get me in a lot of trouble. So little by little, I learned to do what I know is right, not what I think is right. If I have to analyze it, think about it, if I can't just know that it's right and utilize it, I generally forget it. But once in a while, I'll drop back into that stuff about, oh yeah, I got to buy this house and that car and that boat. And I got to get rid of this wife and get another one. You know, I've been married 8 times, you know, 6 on the program. So, you know, like I just can't afford to listen to my head. You know, it lies to me. My instincts do not lie to me. And I hate to go back once again and talk about that other literature, because we do have a lot of real fine literature, but it does talk about over there about misguided instincts. Right? So that's what I found out, is that my head was misguiding my instincts. So, well, I should do that. My head said, no, you shouldn't do that. Or my gut says, well, I really shouldn't hit on my buddy's old lady. And my head said, yeah, do it. You know, right? And I said, yeah, shut up, man. You know. And, you know, so I do the very best I can to do what I know is right and not what I think is right. Now, what I do know and what I do feel is that what you folks are all about here, from the bottom of my gut, it tells me that it's all right. Thank you.